Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, John Russell tells us about a small and special holiday tradition. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Little model villages have long been part of many American families' holiday decorating traditions. The lifelike model villages have small houses, shops, people, and snowy trees. This season, American designers and creative people give advice on how to create your own small winter villages. Dana Isom Johnson is an expert on the crafts site Etsy.com. She said nostalgia, pleasure in remembering something from the past, is an important part of holiday decorations this year. So it's no surprise that tiny Christmas villages are trending, she added. Trending means becoming popular. From snowy layers to modern ceramics with clean lines, families are putting their creative spin on this tradition, she said. Models of little villages from the 1800s came to America with European immigrants. They were popularized even more by F.W. Woolworth, who sold very small, German-made cardboard houses. In the 1970s and 1980s, ceramic houses became popular. The company Department 56 began making theirs in 1976 and still do today. Robin Zachary has a large collection of objects used to make model villages. They include things like cardboard houses, matchbox cars, bottle brush trees, and little people. She likes to set up a model village for the holidays in her New York City home. She advises people interested in making their own villages to consider model train shops. The scale is perfect for a holiday village, she said. Sarah Fishburne is the director of trend and design for the company Home Depot. She said it is a good idea to put small Christmas villages on top of fireplaces or side tables. You could also place one on the floor surrounding your Christmas tree or distribute your pieces throughout a bookcase, she said. If you are making a Christmas village yourself, Fishburne said, get everybody in the family involved. You can find sets of wood and cardboard small houses online. You can add the paint and other decorative elements. Some will fit nicely over a light to shine in the evenings. Kelly Mandel is a blogger in Los Angeles. She turned birdhouses into a modern holiday village using special paint and a shiny material called glitter. Snow and colorful trees added to the playful feeling. You might even include village elements into the branches of a wreath, Fishburne suggests. Americans sometimes put circles of evergreen tree branches called wreaths on their doors. Beyond the traditional look, Fishburne recommends creating something that shows your family's favorite activities. Are you all ice skaters? Do you love to bake? Is a visit to grandparents something you do during the holidays? You could show these things in your model village along with things that bring good memories. Or you could take ideas from the places you have visited in your travels. Fishburne said her family always brings home a little building or other small object from a place they have traveled to. Finally, if there's no space for a large village, Zachary suggests a different kind of family craft project, a village painting. Why not have the kids draw and decorate houses, then pin them up in a row on the wall? Make sure they make some trees, as well as any of your town's significant buildings, she says. I'm John Russell.
The American Space Agency, NASA, says its Orion spacecraft has performed beyond expectations during its test mission to fly around the moon. Orion is set to return to Earth on December 11th. NASA said the uncrewed spacecraft will re-enter Earth's atmosphere and deploy a parachute before splashdown in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California near San Diego. The spacecraft, or capsule, made its second and final close pass by the moon on December 5th. The move brought Orion to within 127 kilometers of the lunar surface. This was the closest any spacecraft built to carry humans has come to the moon since NASA's Apollo 17 mission in 1972. Orion's last pass by the moon happened during an operation NASA describes as a powered flyby burn. The 3.5-minute operation is designed to change the vehicle's velocity and set it on a course back to Earth. 1 week earlier, Orion reached its farthest point in space, about 434,522 kilometers from Earth. That marked the midway point of the spacecraft's 25-day mission. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson looked forward to Orion's return to Earth in a statement. He said when the spacecraft re-enters Earth's atmosphere, it will come back hotter and faster than ever before, the ultimate test before we put astronauts on board. NASA has said Orion will be traveling at speeds up to 32,000 kilometers per hour while re-entering Earth's atmosphere. This is much faster than spacecraft returning to Earth from the International Space Station. The purpose of the Orion mission was to test the capsule as well as NASA's huge Space Launch System, SLS rocket, used to carry it to space. The mission is part of the space agency's Artemis program, which aims to land Americans on the moon by the mid-2020s. The latest mission was called Artemis 1. Its goal is to prepare for Artemis 2, which will include astronauts traveling inside Orion. If all goes well during that mission, NASA will launch Artemis 3 with the goal of landing astronauts on the moon's surface. While Orion has no astronauts on board, NASA placed 3 model humans known as mannequins on the spacecraft. The models are connected to a series of sensors designed to measure radiation and movements throughout the mission. During a recent news briefing, NASA officials said they had been very satisfied with how Orion and its systems had performed during the mission. No major problems have been reported. Mike Serafin is the mission manager for Artemis 1. He told the briefing the mission was going very well. He said because of this, NASA had been able to complete several mission objectives and was able to add some unplanned ones as well. Serafin said that by the time the mission ends, Orion will have traveled more than 2.2 million kilometers. Debbie Korth is the deputy manager for the Orion program. She told reporters, "We couldn't be more pleased about how the spacecraft has been performing, really beyond all our expectations. The last major test of the spacecraft will be to see how its heat shield performs during reentry. The heat shield will have to survive temperatures of around 2,800 degrees Celsius. That temperature is about half that of the surface of the sun. A recovery mission has been organized to pick up the capsule from the Pacific Ocean. NASA's Landing and Recovery Director is Melissa Jones. She said her team of engineers and recovery specialists has worked with U.S. Navy divers attached to the USS Portland transport ship. The divers will help NASA bring in Orion after the spacecraft's splashdown near San Diego. Korth said Orion represents the beginning of a series of increasingly complex missions yet to come in the Artemis program. She added that with the mission progressing so well, "We are really using this spacecraft to push the envelope and see what we can get in terms of performance to prepare for future missions." I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me to talk about a phrase we heard in today's science report. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you, Ashley. Glad to be here.
Your latest science report deals with NASA's Orion spacecraft, which is preparing to return to Earth after a test mission to fly around the moon. One phrase used in the report is the idiom to push the envelope. Brian, can you explain why this idiom was used, as well as what it means?
Sure, Ashley. The basic definition of push the envelope is to reach or extend the limits of what is normally possible. In the report, it was used in a quote by a NASA official. She described how the space agency was looking to Orion to push the envelope to get the very most out of the spacecraft's performance. By setting high limits for Orion, NASA hopes it can better prepare for more complex and riskier missions.
Isn't it also true, Brian, that this idiom came about because it was once used to describe limitations related specifically to airplanes or space vehicles?
Yes, that's correct, Ashley. Some English learners might know that one meaning of the noun envelope is a flat paper container used to mail letters. But Merriam-Webster Dictionary notes that when related to air travel, envelope refers to the operating limits of different kinds of aircraft. So at one time, push the envelope was mainly limited to subjects related to spaceflight.
Of course, we know it is now used to describe many more things.
Yes, that's right.
definitely seems fitting that this idiom was used to describe NASA's latest big space mission. Thanks again for joining me on the show, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 1860 was a year of mixed feelings of hope and fear. Americans had hope for the future because they would be electing a new president. But they had fear that even a new president could not hold the nation together. The states of the South were very close to leaving the Union over the issue of slavery. Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver talk about the candidates and the issues in the election of 1860.
After 4 years as president, James Buchanan decided not to run again. Buchanan was a Democrat. His party, like the nation, was split over slavery. Southern Democrats wanted the party to support slavery. Northern Democrats refused. The opposition Republican Party expected to gain votes from dissatisfied Democrats. Republicans had become stronger since the last presidential election in 1856. They felt their candidate would win in 1860.
The Democratic nominating convention opened in April in Charleston, South Carolina. Senator Stephen Douglas of Illinois was the leading candidate. He had the support of a majority of convention delegates. But he did not have the two-thirds majority needed to win the nomination. Many Southern Democrats did not like Stephen Douglas. Some did not trust him. Others did not accept his policies on slavery. Douglas did not oppose slavery or the spread of slavery. However, he said no federal law could make slavery legal in a territory where the people did not want it. This was his policy of popular sovereignty.
The Southern Democrats who opposed Stephen Douglas were led by William Yancey of Alabama. Yancey wanted to get a pro-slavery statement into the party's platform. He was sure Douglas would not accept the nomination based on such a platform. If Yancey failed to get the statement he wanted, he would take Southern Democrats out of the convention and out of the party. The Committee on Resolutions considered three platforms. One platform declared that the people of a territory had the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The second declared that the Supreme Court had that right. And the third declared that no one did, that slavery was legal everywhere.
Your country, how came it yours? Before the pilgrims landed, we
William Yancey spoke to the convention in support of the pro-slavery platform. He said pro-slavery Democrats did not want to destroy the Union, But he said someone had to make clear to anti-slavery Democrats that the Union would be dissolved if the constitutional rights of slave owners were not honored. Yancey spoke of the danger of a great slave rebellion. He described it as a sleeping volcano that threatened the lives, property, and honor of the people of the South. He said the actions of the North might cause that volcano to explode. Another convention delegate answered Yancey's speech. He said Northern Democrats were tired of defending the interests of the South. Now, he said, Yancey tells us we must agree that slavery is right. He orders us to hide our faces and eat dirt. Gentlemen of the South, he said, you mistake us. We will not do it.
In this atmosphere of tension, it was clear that a pro-slavery platform would not be approved. The Alabama delegation announced that, therefore, it must withdraw. The delegations from the other six states of the Deep South, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, did the same. Those 50 men organized their own convention. They approved a pro-slavery platform, but did not nominate anyone for president. They agreed to meet again a few weeks later in Richmond, Virginia. The Northern Democrats postponed their nomination, too. They agreed to meet again in Baltimore, Maryland.
The Republican Party held its presidential nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. There was no question who was the leading candidate. He was the best-known Republican in the country at that time, Senator William Seward of New York. The Republican platform seemed to contain something for everyone. For those opposed to slavery, the platform rejected the idea that slave owners had a constitutional right to take slaves into new territories. For foreign-born Americans, it supported their right to full citizenship. For manufacturers, it proposed a new tax on imports to protect American industry. And for those in the Northwest, it called for free land for settlers and federal aid to build roads and canals. Delegates approved the platform with loud cheers. They would return the next day to nominate their candidate for president.
William Seward was sure he would win the nomination. If not on the first vote, he thought, then on the second. But there was some opposition to Seward, and his campaign organization failed to see its strength. The candidate of the opposition was Abraham Lincoln. The Republican convention voted three times. Lincoln gained support on each ballot, but neither he nor Seward received enough votes for the nomination. Then, before a fourth vote could be taken, a delegate from Ohio asked to speak. The big room became silent. "Mr. Chairman," he said, "I rise to announce the change of four votes of Ohio to Mr. Lincoln." That was enough to give Abraham Lincoln the Republican nomination for president.
One month later, the Democrats reopened their nominating convention. Most of the Southern Democrats who walked out of the first meeting came back. Many of their seats at the convention had been given to new delegates. So a new dispute arose over which delegates had the right to be there. A compromise plan split the seats between old and new delegates. But most of the Southerners rejected it. One by one, a majority of each Southern delegation walked out. The remaining Democrats then voted for a candidate. They chose Stephen Douglas. Southern Democrats nominated their own candidate, John Breckinridge of Kentucky, and a group called the Constitutional Union Party nominated John Bell.
The election campaign opened in the summer of 1860. Lincoln was not well known, so the Republican Party published many books and pamphlets about him. They told the story of a poor farm boy who educated himself and, through hard work and honesty, had become a candidate for president. Lincoln's supporters organized a loud and colorful campaign, complete with marching bands and signs. Lincoln himself was silent. He said, "It has been my decision since becoming a candidate to make no speeches. I am here only to see you and to let you see me." In fact, it was Lincoln's assistants who had advised him to say nothing. They believed he had said enough in the past to make clear his position on the important issues.
Stephen Douglas, on the other hand, campaigned very hard. His health was poor, and he had trouble getting money, but that did not stop him from speaking in almost every state. Within a few weeks, however, Douglas recognized that he had no real hope of winning. His position on slavery had cost him all support in the South. Douglas believed that, of the other candidates, Abraham Lincoln had the best chance of winning the presidential election. He also believed pro-slavery extremists would use Lincoln's election as an excuse to take Southern states out of the Union. So he turned his efforts to a campaign for the Union itself. He said, "The election of a man to the presidency by the American people, under the Constitution, is no reason for any attempt to dissolve this glorious nation."
Election day was November 6th. The popular vote was close between Lincoln and Douglas, but the electoral vote was not. Lincoln received 180. Breckinridge received 72, Bell received 39, and Douglas received just 12. Abraham Lincoln would be the new president of the United States. He would enter office facing the most serious crisis in American history, for before his inauguration, Southern states finally acted on their threats. They began to leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.